disputes. In a joint statement, the two said, quote, the conditions for finalizing an agreement are not there, end quote. Maybe an in-person chat will do the trick, but Johnson's predecessor, Theresa May, made multiple trips to Brussels, only to have her proposals shot down by her own parliament, effectively ending her political career. Weather in Washington, D.C. right now is 43 degrees and partly cloudy. In New York City, 40 degrees with clear skies. For WPFW in Washington and WBAI New York, I'm Chris Bangert-Drowns. Thanks for listening.
The time now is 5 p.m. Stay tuned for Deadline NYC with Tom Robbins. This is WBAI New York.
Here's some advice for your friend. Don't press your luck. Lay off of me. Don't print that story.
What's that supposed to be? An order?
Listen to me! Print that story, you're a dead man.
It's not just me anymore. You'd have to stop every newspaper in the country now, and you're not big enough for that job. People like you've tried it before, with bullets, prison, censorship. But as long as even one newspaper will print the truth, you're finished.
What's that racket?
That's the press, baby. The press. And there's nothing you can do about it. Nothing.
Welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. I say, welcome to New York, brother. It's a city full of fun. Yeah. They got plenty of rats and roaches. Enough welfare for everyone. They got a whole lot of police cars with their lights all flashing red.
All right, a whole lot of police cars, their lights flashing red. That part's the same. Leon Thomas on vocals, Johnny Hodges on alto, welcoming us to New York, or the New York of 1970, when I guess there was enough welfare for everyone. Before that, the unmistakable growl of Humphrey Bogart, portraying the idealistic newspaper editor in the 1952 film classic Deadline USA, telling the racketeer there's no way, baby, to stop the press. My name's Tom Robbins, and I borrowed or stolen the name of that movie for the name of this show, which I call Deadline NYC. Oh, this past summer, amid all those enormous, vast protests in the wake of the killing of George Floyd, the issue of white racism was front and center in the news, at least for a while. It was certainly a hopeful sign that there were so many white people involved in those protests. And they prompted discussions at home and in the workplace about white supremacy, what it means, how to confront it, how to defeat it. Well, this evening, I'm going to talk with two people who've been at work for decades trying to focus that debate, to find ways to creatively engage people in ways to confront and talk about racism and its impact and consequences for society. I guess the shorthand introduction for John Garvey and Mike Morgan is that they are two members of the editorial group that publishes a unique publication called Hard Crackers, Chronicles of Everyday Life. Both are friends from many years. I met John Garvey when we were both driving yellow taxi cabs in New York City in the early 1970s. But urged on mostly and constantly by John, our group tried to get people to talk about racism and a different kind of society, even while we were agitating for better conditions in the garages. Since his cab driving days, John's worked as an educator, trying to foster literacy. He's worked in New York City jails. He's created programs for students entering city colleges. A few years later, I met Mike Morgan. Another remarkable man, when he showed up in Brooklyn with a group of white South Africans who had courageously refused to serve in their country's military and who were trying to build international awareness of apartheid in support for black self-determination. And since that time, Mike has been applying the lessons learned there to his adopted country here in the U.S. Welcome, John and Mike. Are you with us?
I am.
Yes, I'm here, Tom.
Well, welcome. Thanks for joining us. Listen, I thought we'd start just by briefly talking about your individual backgrounds, both of which I think are pretty unusual for people who have made anti-white supremacy their life's work. John, I'll start with you. You were raised in a mostly white working class neighborhood in South Brooklyn, the son of a subway mechanic. You want to pick up and tell us your story?
Okay, so I wrote down some notes. Hope they're not too wordy. But so
don't write anything down. Just talk. That's fine.
So looking back some 50-odd years, okay, I think there's a plot line that holds together what I've done over those years. But on the other hand, I had no forethought about it. There was no plan. I didn't, ever kind of, this is what I'm going to do, and then I'm going to do this next, whatever, okay? But I thought there were a few moments in retrospect that kind of highlight some kind of aspects of where I was and where I was going. So first off, I just want to emphasize is that, when I was growing up, my dad was a subway worker, okay, and we lived in Sunset Park. There were no radical, presences in our family. To the extent that my dad talked about politics, it was he voted Democrat, as my mom did, all right? And he was a quiet supporter of Mike Quill, the legendary leader of the Transit Workers Union, Local 100, but it was not an especially big part of his life. Nonetheless, by the end of the 1960s, in the midst of all of the turmoil of the time, my dad and I really were at odds with each other all the time, especially around the war in Vietnam. And we really couldn't talk very much about anything, except, as I've pointed out a number of times, we could talk about Pete Hamill and Jimmy Breslin's columns in the tabloids of the time. And so we a debt to both of them for lots of things. At one point later on, when I seemed to be, according to my dad, expressing some favorable views of the Soviet Union, which was a short-lived fantasy, he said to me one day, he says, "Look, I don't understand. How come if things are so bad here and so good over there, no one here wants to go there, and everyone there wants to come here?" It was a good
question. Did that register with you at the time?
Excuse me?
Did that register with you at the time, John?
Yes, it did, but it took a while longer for it to register more substantially. In any case, to go back just a bit, in 1962, I was in 10th grade in a Catholic high school here in Brooklyn, and the school had hired this hotshot basketball coach, a guy named Pat Gleason, so they had to have, teach to earn his salary. I had the misfortune of having him for world history. He was a really cranky reactionary. And so one day he said that he knew that Moscow had organized kind of all of the black folks in the major cities of the United States to on a secret signal to gather outside the cities and to move in and to basically murder as many of the white folks as possible. I simply said something like, "I don't believe that nonsense, okay?"
You're how old at this point?
He threw me out of the room, okay? He made me kneel outside the door for the rest of the period, okay? And I had no idea what I was doing, really. Nonetheless, a year later, another teacher, a guy named Jim Gallagher, showed up at the school. This is a month after the Birmingham church bombing, okay, where the four little girls, got murdered. And Jim sort of throws his books down on the desk. Okay, says, "All right, everyone, stand up. Let's say a prayer for those four little girls." I knew about the bombings, Tom, but it never occurred to me there was anything I could do to make any difference at all, even to say a prayer. That was, it was a startling moment. And so those two very early episodes sort of register still in terms of where I was and where I was going. So fast forward a bit, in 1966, the newly elected mayor, John Lindsay, established a civilian review board. I kind of actively campaigned. Well, actually, let me stop for a second. The PBA, the Patrolmen's Benevolent Association, and the Conservative Party formed an unholy alliance to oppose the review board. And they petitioned for a referendum, which they got enough signatures. So I worked on the campaign to defend the board here in Park Slope, where I kind of have lived for most of the last several decades.
I'm sorry. Give me a sense of how old you are at this point, John.
When I was first year in college,
you're
19,
first year
whatever.
In college. Okay. Right.
So anyway, I kind of handed out flyers, whatever, okay, and met, kind of mostly opposition to what I was saying. But To make a long story short, the referendum was a success for the PBA and the Conservative Party. The review board was defeated. It was a terrible moment, okay, setting the stage for an even maybe arguably more terrible moment 2 years later when the UFT struck against community control in Ocean Hill, Brownsville, and elsewhere over the public schools. But anyway, many years later, I wrote a paper about the Civilian Review Board campaign. And what was really interesting is at the time, in 1966-67, liberal opinion said it was the Catholics who did the review board in. And, you know, maybe it was. So I decided to read, when I was doing this research, the whole year's issues of the weekly Brooklyn Tablet, the Catholic newspaper, which I used to deliver when I was a kid. And I discovered, to my amazement, okay, because it was available on microfilm at the Brooklyn Public Library at Grand Army Plaza, that in the pages of the news, and it was a reactionary rag most of the time. They had supported Franco during the time of the Spanish Civil War. So it was good reason to suspect that they had been bad guys. But anyway, it turned out that they let a million voices flower, okay? People were on all sides of the issue, for and against. So it wasn't the Catholics, okay? At the end of the paper, I said, you know, it was something more interesting and problematic. And that was a white bloc had been consolidated to oppose the review board, bringing together Irish, Italians, and Jews, and others, okay, who had never especially seen themselves before as having a cohesive political identity, but now they did, and they lose a triumphant identity. So,
let me just nod you for a second, John. How did you see yourself fitting into that as you did more research and tried to understand both the historical and the current context? Where was John Garvey in all this?
Well, I wrote that paper in the mid-80s, okay? So it was really quite a bit later. I had been through a lot of things, including, Tom, the years that you and I spent together driving taxis and involved in that group. Tom and I later on worked on a short-lived project called the New York Workers News and Perspective. And we were also part of a small group called People Against White Supremacy. So I had really gone through lots of different, turns in my political development. And, I should mention, 8 years of driving a cab was an invaluable education in itself of meeting cab drivers, that it just was quite extraordinary. I mean, for 8 years I had to answer my mother's questions, what are you going to do
when you grow up, right?
Why
was it invaluable, John? Briefly, why was it invaluable?
Well, one, I think, was to become really deeply knowledgeable about the complexity of the lives of the cab drivers and the complexity of their views. I can tell you a story that's directly related to what we're talking about today. So one day, in a hot summer day, I was working nights, okay, the way it works, as Tom knows, is the day drivers come in, pull up to the gas tanks, the cabs get gassed up, the night driver then takes over the cab and drives off into the sunset. So I was driving, the garage was in Long Island City, I was driving towards the 59th Street Bridge, the sun was blinding in the west, okay, I flipped down the visor, and there was a wad of bills, tied in a rubber band, okay, some cab drivers put their earnings there. So I doubled back around to the garage, okay, and found the driver who had given up the cab, and I walked over to him. I knew who he was, and I said, "You were probably worried." And he said, "No, I knew it was you." Now, what was weird about that is just days before, he and I had a really vicious, almost physical fight over the question of whether cab drivers should pick up black folks, okay? And the fact that because I was prepared to fight him on that issue, that signaled to him that somehow I was trustworthy was really an extraordinary, moment of trying to appreciate, let's not reduce people to one-dimensional cartoons. And that has served me very, very well for, many, many years since then.
Great
I'm going to pass it off to Mike at this point, though. I'll stop.
All right. Well, let me give a brief station ID here. The show's called Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins. We're here on WBAI-FM in New York, Pacifica Radio, and we're talking to two folks, John Garvey and Mike Morgan, who have focused on the issue of white supremacy, coming from very different starting points, but arriving together when they jointly work on a publication called Hard Crackers, that we're going to hear more about a little later in the show. Mike, you were raised in a country where white supremacy wasn't just an ideology, it was a law of the land. Tell us briefly about your own sojourn, if you would.
I was born in South Africa and grew up there. And like all young men who were growing up, I had to go into the army. And I tried as hard as possible to avoid going into the army, but that didn't work out. And so I spent a year in the South African infantry. And that was just after South Africa had invaded Angola. And so it was very lively up there, and there was a lot of nonsense going on. The first opportunity I had to get out, I got out. And I arrived in London, and my sister there, Jenny, introduced me to other people who had been in a similar situation who were organizing around this. And I joined in the very infantile infancy stages of us forming a group of South African war resistors, which were people who were either draft resistors or people who had been in the army, stating, clear opposition to the regime down there and basically support for the black liberation struggle. So that's what got me to London. And when I was in London and working with this group,
I'm sorry, if I can just interrupt for a second, Mike. I just want to make sure readers or listeners, rather, are clear about something, which is when you decided that you wanted to get out of the military, was that, I mean, obviously it was not a great thing to be in, but were you also at that point, I mean, had you made up your mind that this system of apartheid was something that you wanted to oppose or work against or you abhorred? What was your sense about it at that time as you were leaving your own country?
I think it was pretty undeveloped, but I'd chosen a side. What it came down to was, are you going to devote your life to what they want you to do, versus are you going to look for something different? And the experiences that I had in the army made me understand that the difference was important, and I wanted to devote more time to creating that situation. When I arrived in London after we'd got the group going for a while, I was introduced to a fellow who lived here. An older South African, white South African fellow by the name of Don Morton. And Don was somebody who had been involved in sort of previous manifestations of whites organizing against apartheid. He had relationships with people like Breyten Breytenbach, the Afrikaner author, who was imprisoned for a number of years. Don was in a group called Okela, which was a white resistance underground organization in South Africa.
Well, can you just tell us what Okela means? What does that stand for?
I believe it is the Zulu word for spark.
Spark. Thank you.
Yep. Don bent my ear and recruited me to come to the U.S. to plant the war resistor flag there, and I agreed to do it. I never had any notions of coming to this place.
Did you have a notion about America at that point before you arrived?
Yeah, I mean, through films and books and rock and roll, et cetera.
Well, specifically American race relations, is that something that you were at all familiar with? Or?
Yes, but not in a sophisticated way at all. I mean, one of the things that we had when I was a kid growing up was that we had this enormous jigsaw puzzle that was a jigsaw puzzle of the United States, and each piece was a different state. And I kind of remember doing that. I seem to remember like dolphins in Florida and surfboards in California. And probably if I looked real carefully, there was probably a prison in New York. But I didn't really know much about this country. So when I arrived, I was pretty much dependent on Don. And, within 2 weeks, we made this formal announcement at a press conference at the UN, at which Dave Dillinger stood next to me and spoke.
Was that someone you knew of, or were you meeting Dave Dillinger, the great war resister, for the first time?
I was hearing of these people for the first time. I mean, I knew a little bit about the Panthers. I knew a little bit about, the Olympiads and Ali and all of that stuff. But it was...
What year is this when you had your press conference at the UN, Mike?
78.
I'm sorry?
1978. And Dillinger was very nice, Dave Dillinger. He realized that it was kind of like quite a nerve-wracking experience for me, because that was when we kind of shut the door. You know, there's no turning back here. You're more or less declaring yourself persona non grata. So he invited Don and I, after the press conference at the UN, to come with him, and he took us to a Blarney Stone in 3rd Avenue, which is a kind of cheap chain of Irish bars.
Of which there were a few back then, okay.
And there certainly were. And that helped. And he talked me through it, too. And then we set off on the big adventure. The adventure was a speaking tour across the country. And
what was your message in the speaking tour, Mike? What were you trying to convey to people?
Well, we were talking about the role of South Africa's war machine, its backers, and ways to oppose it. But specifically, we were also talking about what we saw as a role of whites, and it was a developing thing for me. But Don had a relatively sophisticated analysis on it, which I was buying into. I was agreeing with this, and that was that he believed that white South Africans had to earn the right to live as equals, and that His line was that the road to humanity lay in actively refusing, not just actively refusing to go along with the system, but also throwing our lot in with the aspirations of the oppressed people. And, racism is a white people's creation, and therefore white people in South Africa had a particular responsibility to help undo it. And that this required more than just repudiating the program, but it meant exploring and enacting ways to undermine it. In other words, how to disrupt the white bloc. And our shtick was refusing to comply with military service. So that's where we were coming from, and that was the position that was put out. And then we went on this, this remarkable journey across the country, which, I felt like I was the character in the Johnny Cash song, I've been everywhere.
how many of you were there on this journey?
It was just me and Don. It was me and Don in a bad Dodge station wagon that broke down regularly. But, you know, we started off at the UN, and we were in Boston, and then we were in the Midwest, and then we were
And when you spoke to people, how did that go over when you would get audiences?
It went over pretty well. I mean, a lot of the time we were speaking to audiences who wanted to come to these things. So there were a lot of black audiences. There were a lot of black students. There were, you know, organizations that put their support behind this and got their people out. And, you know, we did radio work. We were interviewed by Studs Terkel once in Chicago.
Is that right? Hmm.
You know, I have to say that it was a real eye-opener for me, the whole damn thing. I mean, we went all the way across to the West Coast. We went down through Texas and the Deep South, and we covered the length and breadth of this country, talking up the cause. You know, Woody Guthrie would have been proud of us.
Mm-hmm.
That's what got me started here. And then Don kind of leaned on me to stay, and that didn't take much leaning, because at that point I was really fascinated by the potential here and the dynamic that existed. There was still a lot of holdover and fallout from the 60s and the Vietnam War, et cetera. It was a rich road to hoe.
Was there a point along that road, Mike, that you began to see some similarities between the kind of racism that you had escaped from and the kind of racism that you encountered in America?
Yeah, that was about 2 days after I arrived. Yeah.
Okay.
No, I was seeing that all the time. And, of course, the people I was meeting were reinforcing that, not from the aspect of being racist, but from being the aspect of fighting racism. You know, and that was a very interesting eye-opener for me also, was to get to know these various individuals, a lot of whom I regard as real heroes. And a lot of them are just unknowns. I mean, I could talk about a few of those people.
Give us a couple of names of those heroes who were so influential on you at that point.
Well, you know, one of the people that I really got to know quite well was from Southern Africa. He was his name was Tapson Mweri, and he was for a number of years in the first part of the 70s, Tapson was the official North American representative of ZANU, which was the party which later governed Zimbabwe and still does. And Tapson was motivated by the desire that the guerrillas and activists on the ground deserved to have a voice. And that was what motivated him. And he started a number of successful campaigns here. He organized longshoremen in Louisiana not to offload ships carrying Rhodesian coal. And by the mid-70s, before I arrived, he had developed a political critique, I would say, of the Mugabe faction in ZANU. And he was stripped of his position. So by the time I met him in 1979, he was pretty much alone. And he had written another important critique about the negotiated settlement at Lancaster House. And when the dust had settled, he was given no recognition for the efforts he made. But Tapson knew people. Tapson was very close to a fellow called Anthony Lewis. And Anthony Lewis was, he was a longtime black liberation activist, and he was an anti-war activist from Norfolk, Virginia. His group was called the Black Vanguard Resource Center. And his experience was organizing sailors in Norfolk. because that was where the U.S., Atlantic Fleet was headquartered, and that was also where NATO was headquartered. Anyway, Tapson's nickname for Anthony was the Tidewater African, which I always liked.
And would you mind just give us Captain's name slowly or spell it so that listeners can learn more about him if they want to?
His name was Tapson, T-A-P-S-O-N, Maweri, M-A-W-E-R-E. He died in the early 90s.
Remarkable man. Look, we're going to take
There's one other guy I just want to talk about, and this is very brief.
He's got to be brief because we've got to take a break. Go ahead.
Right, was a fellow called Walter Collins, who was part of that circle, too. And Walter was the first black draft resistor jailed for being a black draft resistor during the Vietnam era. So those are some of those people.
Now, those were impressive people to meet on a trip to New America by someone who'd never been here before. But we're going to take a short musical break, and we'll be back with Mike Morgan and John Garvey to talk about their publication, Hard Crackers, Chronicles of Everyday Life. Reggie, we got this tune lined up. Excuse to play a Randy Newman tune, and I'm really very fond of that one. So this is, again, Deadline NYC. My name's Tom Robbins. We're here in WBAI-FM, Pacifica Radio in New York, and I'm talking to two people, John Garvey and Mike Morgan, who have focused most of their adult life trying to talk and educate and work against white supremacy. And they are among the editors of a remarkable publication called Hard Crackers, Chronicles of Everyday Life. John, before we talk about Hard Crackers, you used to help edit a magazine called, I think, Race Traitor, subtitled The New Abolitionism. And it had this remarkable motto, treason to whiteness is loyalty to humanity. Could you just tell us what that meant? What was that? What did you mean by the motto and by new abolitionism? What were you trying to do there?
Well, I mean, the second one first. Okay, new abolitionism was a very intentional effort to try to kind of place ourselves in the tradition of the 19th century abolitionists, black and white, who had waged the campaign, eventually successfully, against slavery that culminated in the Civil War. We then and now appreciated that event, abolition and the Civil War and Reconstruction, as being the most remarkable events in human history, and that too often get overlooked and not appreciated for the the arming of the runaway slaves, okay, leading to the victory of the Union Army against the Confederacy and things of that sort. The slogan of treason to whiteness was kind of basically a call to a certain kind of to arms, but arms in not so much in the literal sense, but rather in the perhaps in the kind of in the same way that when John Brown led the raid against at Harper's Ferry, okay, and his what he oftentimes used to say was, "Remember them that are in bonds, as if bound with them," kind of an assertion of the kind of the primacy of the need for human solidarity. So the treason to whiteness slogan was in some ways just another way of saying that an injury to one is an injury to all, and to take that literally, to take that seriously as a starting point for politics. So just to go back, Race Trader was a journal that was published from 1993 to 2005. I was the founding co-editor with Noel Ignatiev, a friend for a long time who died just over a year ago, and who was instrumental in the launching of the Hard Crackers Project, which we'll get to in a moment. And Race Trader had, you know, kind of a remarkable shelf life. Even to this day, copies of the kind of the anthology that we published somewhere along the way continue to be sold. And I keep meeting, you know, young men and women now in their 40s, okay, who talk about being influenced by Race Trader when they were teenagers. I didn't even know that they were reading us. But so that, you know, sometimes you just don't know what kind of good benefit you have. What you do.
That's certainly true. But just one last piece of that before we talk about your current publication. John Brown, of course, was, you know, when he was calling for treason to whiteness and invoking the idea of, like, consider the bondsman the same way that you would be bound by the same. You weren't calling people to arms. When you said treason to whiteness, what were you summoning people exactly to do?
That's a good question. I mean, I think that we were, you know, there were some times when we actually endorsed, embraced, and advocated for very specific actions. I think that more often we were trying to encourage people to look around and to kind of notice and to discover the ways in which whiteness was systematically structured and maintained by kind of the institutional workings of things like the schools, the police, the court system and whatever, and to rise up, okay, to try to dismantle, to fundamentally transform those institutions into something new and different. You mentioned at the very beginning of the show tonight, Tom, about the upsurge in protests that occurred this past summer. I mean, you know, if you asked us what we wanted, okay, there you have what we wanted. That's what we were, you know, okay. I didn't see that coming.
Okay. Well, Mike, so Hard Crackers, Chronicles of Everyday Life, is a very different kind of publication. It doesn't sort of take that kind of overt political stance. It seems to try and give people a voice, as you say, to talk about their everyday lives. But the goal is really to talk about race and racism and how it intersects in their everyday lives. Is that fair, Mike?
It's one of the goals. I would say that, you know, a lot of it has to do with essentially the distinction between people who don't have much versus the few who do have much. Who do have quite a bit, so it doesn't just focus necessarily on race relations. It focuses on class relations too. I'm sorry, what was the rest of your question?
That was a conscious decision then to sort of expand your lens when you created Hard Crackers.
Well, I think so. I mean that. To more or less see things as that in this world there are all sorts of people who you know, live in relative misery or discomfort or at least not in control of the circumstances that control them, and that in the course of those lives. People are involved in various struggles, and to talk about those struggles and to document them in some way. And sometimes people aren't even conscious of them, but they are conditions that people are caught up in. For example, you know, we've had people write who are just talking about what it's like to be in a halfway house, or what it's like to come out of prison, or examples like that, where they're not necessarily part of an organized political struggle that's going on, but they are involved in the struggle to stay alive, and that paying attention to those details is something that we think is important.
Well, let's just talk for a minute about some of the, that's a couple of the stories that have been in Hard Crackers. John, how do you guys decide what's going to be in it, and how does the publication happen? You're two members of an editorial board. There are others,
right?
Correct?
Yes, there are six others. When we launched in the spring of 2016, I guess more or less, kind of in the midst of the eventually successful Trump campaign, we kind of made a couple of decisions, one of which is that we would mostly try to kind of decide by consensus. That's mostly served us well. Second, that we would focus our efforts on a print publication, an old-fashioned publication that will come out perhaps twice a year. It's harder to circulate those kinds of things nowadays than it used to be. There are fewer distributors. There are fewer bookstores. It's harder to collect the money and so forth. So we would also have a web page, but the web page would be seen as decidedly secondary. And that served us pretty well until earlier in 2020, when all hell broke loose. And I mentioned that Noel, who had really been the guiding spirit of the Hard Crackers project, because I was doing some other things as well, he had died in November of 2019. And so the rest of us had a big decision to make, is will we continue? Will we continue trying to do the project? We decided to say yes. But then once the epidemic hit, we kind of had to shift our gears quite a bit and to focus almost entirely on the website. And over the course of the last 9 or 10 months, I think we probably have posted somewhere between 50 or 60, 70 articles related first to the kind of to the epidemic, to people's experiences and in workplaces, in hospitals and schools, and people's experiences in prison. We wrote a couple of pieces about Rikers Island, one about Angola in Louisiana, one about Truesdale, a facility in Tennessee, a woman's prison out in Arizona. And then, come the George Floyd rebellion, we had, another kind of whole set of things to write about, and we have been trying to cover those kinds of developments with reports from the streets of, and with some political analysis of trying to make some sense of the different forces that are at play. I should also kind of mention that we have devoted a considerable amount of time and effort to trying to understand Trump and to understand his supporters. We've written articles about the rallies. We've written articles about the composition of the, who are Trump supporters and what are their reasons for. We did some early interviews with people who voted for Trump. Since the kind of epidemic, it's become harder for it to have that same kind of one-on-one contact with people. We've been, forced to rely more on observations. But we've done some really fine work of reporting from the ground up.
I want to ask you about that, but let me just to draw a line, which you tell me if it's right or wrong, but a lot of political publications have, a kind of ideological test that they might apply to their copy that they would put in. Do you have such a thing? Is there one common thread that you're looking for, aside from people talking about their everyday experiences and their struggles? Is there anything
our net is, I think, a pretty wide net. I mean, there are probably some things that we would not publish. I can count those, over the course of, 4 years now, a handful of things that we decided for one reason or another. We do, we rely on two sources. One is ourselves. Secondly, our friends or, people who are our political allies. And then third, unsolicited manuscripts that come our way, that kind of oftentimes, which are some of the best things that we've done. Earlier in a conversation with you, Tom, I mentioned this interview that I had done with Marty Brown, one of the descendants of John Brown, who lives out in Portland, and, I reached out to her cold. I said, "You don't know me, would you be willing to do this?" And she said, yes. And it was certainly one of the most remarkable things we've been able to post. So, no, I mean, I think I wouldn't want to say that we have no political perspective on those matters, but it's a fairly broad and wide open one, because I think that we have learned a bit is that we don't want to think that we're too sure about everything that we know, or that we're sure that we're right. You know,
well, there's an unusual political perspective, or at least.
Yeah,
so. Let me give a quick station ID one more time. This is WBAI FM Pacifica Radio, New York, 99.5. The show's called Deadline NYC. My name is Tom Robbins, and I'm here talking to John Garvey and Mike Morgan, two people who are involved in the publication Hard Crackers, Chronicles of Everyday Life. Let me, in the few minutes that we've got left, I wanted to come back a little bit to the phenomenon of 74 million people who voted for a man who barely disguised his own racism and often welcomed racists to his following. And yet, do you believe that those 74 million people are overwhelmingly racist and they're a lost cause? Mike, you got a take on that?
Now, or are you doing the station break?
No, that's live. This is live radio where anything goes. So,
yeah, I mean, I have a take on that. I regard Trump as big trouble, and I don't make any bones about it. I always think that a large mass community is open territory. We can find people, and we can talk to people, and we can struggle about those kinds of things in a way that we might be able to make some important arguments. I don't write 74 million people off. I mean, obviously there are diehard sections and there are nutty sections, but I'm always confident that people can change. That's been my experience, and I'm not somebody who says write that entire community off. I don't think so.
Dan, you want to talk about that for a second?
I pretty much agree with what Mike just said. I mean, I kind of just want to cite one report that one of our editors, Jared Shanahan, submitted from a Trump rally in Kenosha, Wisconsin, right before the election was held. And Jared describes that he was absolutely enthralled by the kind of being at the rally, that he kind of almost felt like he was in the presence of a rock star, that he was completely caught up in the excitement, the momentum, whatever. And at one point, Trump made some kind of comment about some special cruelty that he inflicted on people at the southern border, and the people erupted into cheers. And then at that point, Jared, and he writes this, Jared's reaction was, screw these people. Now, he had just 2 minutes earlier talked in some ways about how he kind of appreciated who they were. They didn't seem to be monsters and whatever, But then they were willing to support a monstrous deed. And I think that reserving some ambivalence or complexity about those judgments is pretty important. You don't want to, give in to kind of endorsing when people subscribe to really awful, horrible things. At the same time, you don't want to write them off forever and forever.
Right. I mean, I would say about that, Tom, is that, a lot of the time it's important where people land. And I think that's part of what John and Jared was saying in his article. It doesn't matter how kind of appealing or possibly swayed these people might be on different kinds of things. Where they land and what they're endorsing is a pretty horrible thing. And at that point, you've got to call it for what it is.
I know that, as John just said, part of your kind of overall ethos for your publication and your thinking about it is not to assume that all the answers. But I wonder if you do have things that you would say to people now who are struggling with the idea, who want to take part in making sure that they shed their white skin privilege, that they also participate in the battle against white supremacy? Do you have things to say to those folks as to what you think that they might think about at least taking on and doing, John?
You know, I think that, you know, back, it seems like ages and ages ago, Tom, during the days of the police, you know, kind of protest, that we wrote, you know, some things that we kind of were in the form of, not quite advice, but sort of, you know, things we thought people should be alert to, one of which was the kind of very likely attempt that kind of there would be kind of efforts to suppress those movements, that there would be kind of infiltrations and that people needed to be prepared to kind of not be defeated by them or undermined by them. I think perhaps another way of saying it, Tom, is we think it's valuable for people to learn the lessons of history. You know, when I kind of think back to my formative political experiences, you know, of the 60s and 70s, okay, there were things that I think that I learned. I'm actually recently we published a review in Heartcrackers, a review of the movie of the trial of the Chicago Seven by someone, you know, who was an activist in the 60s, and simply kind of pointing out that there were things about the movement, whatever the flaws of the movie were, separate and apart from that, that are really pretty valuable for people to learn and then to make their own conclusions, to draw their own conclusions from that. But that there was actually I sent the review to a young woman friend of mine who lives down in Florida. And, you know, her reaction is that she kind of, it's really important for kind of young people to understand that there was a time when lots and lots of white folks were on the streets active, you know, kind of in the causes of a lot of different things, fighting against the war, fighting against, you know, all sorts of miserable things. And that's not in a history that's especially well known. And so perhaps there are better ways of doing it. And actually, Mike, you know, earlier spoke about Dave Dellinger. And, you know, just a sort of side plug, I thought that the representation of Dellinger in the movie was okay, but not nearly as good as it could have been. You know, he was a remarkable hero.
All right. You know, speaking of heroes, just briefly, we have to stop in a couple of minutes, but you've mentioned Noel Ignatieff a couple of times. Mike, can you want to say just briefly who was Noel and why was he so important to you? And we only have about a minute left.
Okay. Well, I mean, I met Noel in 1979, and, you know, he was interested in us because he was interested in the role of whites. And he was part of an organization called Sojourner Truth Organization, which was more or less kind of adopted us as a group that was trying to figure out ways in which white people could, you know, get involved in a more radical kind of struggle and, you know, forge a different kind of unity, not a false unity with other communities.
Yeah, I just want to say, Tom, the best thing that Noel ever did is he introduced me and Mike to each other.
Well, there you go. Tell us right now before we go, John, how do listeners get a hold of Hard Crackers? How do they find it online? Well, how do they support it?
We're going to publish two print issues in the early part of this next year, okay? We don't have definite dates yet.
And how do they find it?
They'll be announced on the webpage. It's hardcrackers.com. We urge people to read the page. We also urge, you know, people who are listening to submit articles. Okay, we're kind of wide open. We welcome contributions from just about anybody. Okay, and so please, and we're I think I would describe us as being good editors in the sense that our job is not to kind of figure out ways to not publish things, but rather to figure out ways to make things as good as they can possibly be and put them up.
Those are my kind of editors. I'd like to hear that. It's hardcrackers.com. Is that right?
Yes, hardcrackers.com.
Okay. All right. We got to go. Thank you so much, John Garvey and Mike Morgan.
I really appreciate it. Both of us do. Okay? Take care.
Really appreciate you being here and taking the time.
Bye-bye.
Oliver Nelson's Stolen Moments is going to take us on out. Thank you again for being here this week. I'm Tom Robbins. You can reach me at Tommy Rob on Twitter if you care to. Take care.
We live in complicated times. Sometimes it seems like important voices get left out, and sometimes it's hard to know who to trust. But one thing's for sure. For more than 60 years, WBAI has been your go-to for independent, non-commercial, free speech programming. Join the WBAI family as a BAI buddy in the name of your favorite show today and support radio you can trust. It's easy. Just go to WBAI.org or call 516-620-3602. That's 516-620-3602. When you become a WBAI buddy, you show your support for great programs on politics, news, the arts, music, and culture. You show your support for real free speech radio. Go to WBAI.org or call 516-620-3602 now. Don't wait. You know these times are too important. Please give as generously as you can. It's simple to make a recurring monthly donation, and it only takes a minute. Just go to WBAI.org and click Ways to Donate. Unlike living in New York, it is that easy. WBAI has spoken up for New Yorkers for more than 60 years. Now, it's time to speak up for WBAI. Go to WBAI.org to support radio you can trust. Give to WBAI today. Be heard.
Hello, I'm Michael G. Haskins, one of the staff members here at WBAI. WBAI's local station board, responsible for advising local management and operations, will be holding a public meeting on Wednesday, December 9th at 7 p.m. The meeting will be a remote access meeting with an opportunity for public comment. The local station board will consider who the LSB officers, the president, vice president, treasurer, and secretary will be this year. Again, that's Wednesday, December 9th at 7 p.m. The meeting, held through the Zoom remote meeting service, can be accessed by calling in the U.S. 929-205-6099 and entering the meeting ID 922-457-2995. The telephone number to call is 929-205-6099, and meeting ID is 922-457-2995. A link to instructions, including for listening over the web, and how to submit written comments will be available through WBAI's main webpage. Do you have to contribute to WBAI to access the meeting? Of course not. But why not?
On Tuesday, December 8th from 7 to 9 p.m., tune to WBAI New York and WPFW DC for a special called Battle for Community Radio to learn about the latest attempt to remove community from WBAI, WPFW, and Pacifica's governance system. A group called New Day Pacifica is attempting to run another referendum to ram through changes to Pacifica rules to end effective community involvement in the Pacifica network. Learn from activists, organizers, and board members about the threat Pacifica faces and why we need to oppose it. That's on Tuesday, December 8th from 7 to 9 p.m. on WBAI New York and WPFW DC.